Welcome to the Donnybrook Podcast. This is your host, David.
I'm Amanda.
And John.
And we are so happy to have you here.
And that's the melodious sounds of, who is that? The Decemberists with their new single.
John, keeping us fresh with some brand new theme music, bumper music.
Yes, from our good friends in Portland.
Oh, is that where the Decemberists are from?
Yes, David. That's why I said they're from Portland.
See, did you notice how I made that sound like I really knew who the Decemberists were yeah. and I'd actually heard of them before?
You haven't heard of the Decemberists before?
Nope, not too much.
Oh, that's terrible.
I've even heard of them. And if I've heard of them, you definitely should have.
Well, if I wasn't here podcasting with you lovely folks, I would probably be at the theater watching Infinity War, because that comes out tonight. So much fun.
That does sound like fun.
What's that a movie about, David? I've not heard of this.
Infinity War has all the Marvel superheroes. And when I say all, I really do mean all. Like, it has Thor and Spider-Man and...
The Tick?
Well, I don't think it has the Tick.
Does it have Star-Lord?
It has Star-Lord.
It's just... See me making a culturally relevant reference.
I know. I'm pretty impressed.
Thank you. I actually went to see a movie recently.
Which is
my
see?
First one for 2018.
What?
I did.
Wow.
I discovered the delight of the VIP section at the Village Cinema. Are they sponsoring us now? I don't know. But
Sponsored by the Village Cinema.
And the Decemberists.
For $2 extra, you get a seat that's actually comfortable and you can buy real food.
Really expensive real food.
Yes.
But
and also
fun.
Really expensive beer. But not that I would know.
They have lots of really fancy desserts there too.
That's really nice.
Oh yeah.
I think I need to go to the movies more so I can sit in the comfy chair and order french fries.
Okay, who cares? What did you watch? That's the interesting part.
Oh, I went and watched Black Panther.
Oh.
Ooh.
What did you think? Have you seen that yet, David?
Yes, I did see that.
Okay, so we've all seen Black Panther.
We've all seen Black Panther.
I went the first weekend.
Oh my.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You are on it.
Yeah, I went with Ethan.
So. I went like 2 weeks ago, so clearly I'm behind the curve.
I go to like 2 movies a year on the first weekend. So,
and so what'd you guys think of Black Panther?
John?
It's been a while since I've seen it. I don't have...
Your thoughts left.
Yeah, my thoughts have all left. It was provocative.
Mm-hmm.
In good ways, provocative. But it was definitely provocative.
I like how you put that provocative in good ways. Mm-hmm. To make you think about things that you probably need to think about.
Yeah. And right. And I thought it pushes a lot of buttons, and I think a lot of them are the right buttons to push. I like how it's definitely a movie about race, and yet the main antagonist in the film is black, is African American.
It's a movie about race that doesn't pit the races against one
another.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it does, but it's in the background. It's not mm-hmm. in the foreground. And so it works better where there seems to be at least a recognition that this is a movie about black, what it means to be a black, free-willed person, and that other black people often are our enemies rather than us working together. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really interesting way to tell the story about racism and to tell the story that really, I mean, that a lot of the problems in America, a lot of the problems that Black Panther is trying to address has everything to do with slavery and has everything to do with racism. But it didn't make that the primary, like, hinge point.
I really enjoyed how it seriously engaged with the issues of the black experience in America versus a admittedly fantasy world of black independence, and how it forced the imaginary world of Wakanda to deal with the injustices in the wider world. I thought that was very well done.
Now, see, that was the part I probably felt like was a little too idealistic.
The Wakanda itself, or
the injustice. How do you deal with injustice in the world? I felt, and I give it a little bit of a pass because they have to develop that more. But
in future films,
right. But it felt a little like we can be, we can fix it if we try hard enough. It felt like, you know how you get to the end of Disney movies and you're like, uh-huh.
Yeah, that's like, not kind of how it not felt. Enough. Well, I think that that's an element of the genre, not a true weakness of the filmmaker's engagement with the ideas. But I mean, obviously those are much larger questions than you can deal with in a superhero movie. But that we have to repent of refusing to engage with something difficult. That was,
yeah, agreed.
That was very well stated. Obviously there wasn't room to develop how does that engagement really look in the long term, and what are the totally. What are the complexities of that?
You that's, just that's fly your spaceship into the middle of downtown Oakland,
and it's all better.
Start a youth center. That's how you deal with it. Obviously,
easy peasy.
Gosh.
Although I think the film did really signal a sense that there were complexities that were not going
absolutely.
To be easily addressed.
Absolutely,
I felt like that was intellectually honest.
I don't. So I don't really do superhero films. So you say you're excited about going and seeing Infinity War?
Yeah. It sounds like fun. It looks
you're
like
you're nodding
a fun,
over there. Why are
movie?
You nodding? We're podcasting.
it looks fantastic. Well, everybody can hear me nodding, right?
Yes.
It just looks fun. It looks like a great, fun, enjoyable film. Yeah. I'm not going to it for any deep sense of purpose. I'm going to it purely for entertainment.
And see, I have not gotten into the genre. Like it hasn't hit me. And I love science fiction films. I love action films. I love clever things. I have just not gotten into this genre. So like, I think even like the parts that bothered me the most in Black Panther were the superhero parts where you've got like, yeah, you know, spoiler alert, but you've got, I don't know, stupid guns and stupid rhinoceros. I mean, it's just, I don't know.
Oh, you mean the over-the-top stuff?
The over-the-top battle sequences at the end, and you're just like, oh, when's this going to end?
You know, the thing about...
And I felt the same way about, like, Lord of the Rings, where, okay, now we have a batter orc, and we have a batter, you know. Whatever.
Well, certainly The Hobbit got a little ridiculous.
Well, it didn't start
don't
with the
start,
Hobbit. It was definitely the Battle of Pelennor Fields.
Oh, this is
and
fun.
The scrubbing bubbles.
Scrubbing bubbles?
Right. The Army of the Dead, they're the scrubbing bubbles. They just sweep across the battlefield leave the dead. Right? That like that's literally what that looks
they
like.
They came out of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right. It was
and
a little
swept
yes,
over.
Yes. Agreed. Yeah. That was pretty terrible.
Right.
So
and also didn't happen in the book, but you know, that's neither here nor there.
I'm sorry I brought it up, David. Move us on. Segway.
Moving along. I liked... I found myself in the middle of Black Panther. At one point, I thought I was totally, completely lost in this film.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about where I was in the theater or looked at my watch or noticed what time it was. I just was absolutely lost in the film.
Absorbed by the storytelling... wrapped up in the visuals and the fun of that.
And yeah, I thought it was good. I thought I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it even though I don't love superhero films. So you have the movie pass thing, right?
Yes.
So
is that
what
still
is
going?
It is still going. It
has been a little while since we've recorded, so I don't know what's still
what's
current
still
and what's
I
not.
I have kind of not really gone a lot lately.
Let's break down that sentence.
I've kind of not really
like gone lately. Is that what you just said?
That was a terrible sentence.
I love you, but no.
I would like to apologize about that. I am mortified. That was a harrowing sentence
this
for anybody to have to
is
sit
brought
through.
To you by the Decemberists. What else?
The Village Cinema.
The Village Cinema and Webster's Dictionary.
I was going to say
your local grammar Nazis.
And your local grammar.
Drunken White's Elements of Style.
There you go. There, that's better.
And reference. Other things David has not read.
So my question was, what with that movie pass, since you get to see everything that you want to see potentially, what has been your one recommendation of the year? Would Black Panther be the top of the list?
Boy, that's a good question.
Okay, we're coming back.
I can tell you that I really enjoyed 7 Days in Entebbe.
Huh?
Which
is that a movie?
It is. It's a. It's a.
What was the last word again?
Entebbe. It's a little African. It's a story.
Careful.
A story in. It's a story about.
It wasn't awkward until John made it awkward.
It's a story from the 70s about some terrorists that hijacked an airplane, took it down into South Sudan, I think, and it was headed from Berlin to France, and then they took all the Jews off. And
careful,
like, you know, like it was like a bunch of Palestinian terrorists and German terrorists that came in and were trying to get some of their people released. And it was a very, really interesting film.
Movie for the family?
A movie for the older kids.
Older kids, okay.
Yeah. I would say, though, that the movie that has made the biggest impression on me was not something I saw in the movie theater. I saw it on Netflix, and that's Wind River.
Wind River. You were telling me about this the other night.
What? Yeah. It's got...
So you're telling me I shouldn't have canceled my Netflix account.
Yeah, you should watch. I think you would it's really enjoy it.
It's too late. I already canceled already my gone. Netflix account.
I didn't think you even had a Netflix account.
I did. Now I don't.
Okay. No, it's an interesting movie. It's about this tracker in Wyoming who finds a body and ends up calling it in, and he finds out he knows who this is that's died out in the middle of nowhere. And
on an Indian reservation.
On
right?
an Indian reservation. Yep. Okay. And careful.
Careful. And, Native American reservation.
And it just ends up being a very surprising movie. Jeremy Renner delivers a really deep, well-rounded...
that was really, very much movie reviewer language there. It's really, he delivers a really
delivers
deep...
Delivers a...
Yeah.
And
probably maybe like...
It's a very... It really talks a lot about grief and a lot about... how to move on from... terrible things that happen in your life. It's a really well done film. I really liked it a lot.
Interesting.
Definitely not a film for the entire family.
Oh, okay.
Probably okay. not for the entire family.
A little rough.
Yeah.
In a couple of places. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So you have watched some movies and.
Oh, I went to see Paul, the Apostle of Christ. That was fun.
And did Jesus do a good job playing Luke?
It was a little weird.
Wait,
it was a little weird.
Jesus played Luke?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus.
What?
We call him Jesus in this movie.
Jim Caviezel plays Luke.
Luke.
Yeah.
Doesn't he know that he...
I know.
He kind of like...
It feels cast a little himself? Weird. It feels a little weird, especially because he's getting ready to play Jesus again in the new... Mel Gibson movie that's coming out soon.
Which is weird. Let's be
honest. He's going to play Jesus again?
Yes. Yeah. Mel Gibson's doing another
sequel.
A sequel.
Wait.
Yeah.
So like.
You didn't know this?
No. Well, me out of the loop? What?
Well, you know, yeah. Jim Caviezel is playing and he's playing.
In, is this like resurrected Jesus?
Yes.
Or is this?
Yes. My understanding is it's like spiritual warfare kind of stuff.
I think. There's a part of the movie that's going to be when he goes down to hell and kicks
really?
Devil butt. Can I say that on the podcast? I guess I just did.
It's our podcast. You can yes. say whatever you want.
Kicks
devil derriere.
Oh my goodness.
It sounds like a drink.
That
sounds
somehow
like
makes it worse,
drink.
Not better.
It kind of does, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Devil butt IPA.
Oh, that is pretty bad.
What? Yeah, I just think it sounds awful. The premise for the film just sounds terrible to me.
Well, I think a film about Jesus's ministry could be good, and
yeah,
it could be well done.
Hasn't that already been done?
Biblical extrapolation,
right?
Or
well, deep into Catholic tradition versus straight out of New Testament writings. There's a pretty dramatic.
Right.
How many times have you guys watched The Passion?
I actually show it to my students every year.
Do you?
If you want to talk about interesting experiences.
Do you have to get permission?
I notify parents every year. It's a part of our curriculum. It's been authorized by our administrators. So as officially part of the curriculum, I don't have to get permission slips or anything, but I notify parents and they can opt their students out, which I've only had one student opted out in 3 years. But yeah, I watch it with my students each year.
Why is that considered?
Well, we have a couple of rationales for it. We teach that historical period in, well, my current job. I got a new job, by the way.
Oh,
at the same place.
Ooh,
new position. But currently, as
her new position is butt kicking,
devil
butt kicker.
Well, yes. That was the old position.
Now I have a new one. So in the sophomore year at my school, we teach ancient history, and our historical period spans the birth of Christ, and we teach the book of Matthew as part of our curriculum, and so it definitely fits with our curriculum anyway. The way the timing of the year works out, we always are teaching Matthew right around Easter.
Ooh, that's
and neat. So the timing of it, yes, it's very fortuitous. And we teach it, so right around Easter, we're beginning to teach Matthew. So I have a tradition of showing the Passion on, we always have Good Friday off. So the Thursday before Easter, we show the Passion. One of the things that Mel Gibson did that was really effective was the use of Aramaic, Greek, and Latin as spoken languages, which we teach Greek and Latin at the school. And so it's really good for the students to hear them as spoken languages. And I, you know, as an explicitly Christian school, I think it's really good to walk through that with students. It seems developmentally appropriate for 16-year-olds. Parents can opt their students out, and then they end up reading relevant passages from the New Testament instead. Different gospel accounts of the crucifixion. But it's been a really wonderful experience.
Do your students, what kind of effect does it have on your students?
We all cry. I mean, so this year was my fifth time watching it, because I watched it twice when it first came out, and then now I've watched it 3 years in a row, and everybody cries. That's a given.
I watched it this year on the weekend, I think on Friday.
On Good Friday.
Yeah. And what a really well done movie.
Yeah.
It's art. It is art.
It's not, in my opinion, it's not perfect, but it is very, very well done.
Sure, of course not.
And very effective. It's moving emotionally. And to a generation or two or three, I don't know how many generations we are into, of being just saturated with media violence and dramatic portrayals of things, it brings an immediacy to the gospel account that I think is important for us to face up to. And I think it's, in my experience, students experience it as far more real than portrayals of violence they've seen before, and far more important.
You mean this is more real than mm-hmm. somebody riding a rhinoceros with a blaster gun shooting at laser
shocking.
Ships? In an imaginary African nation.
I'm pretty sure Black Panther is in no way a standard for the violence that they've seen, but the cartoonish and excessive violence is, it's pervasive in different forms of media that they consume. I think I'd underestimated how important video games would be to my students, and that's definitely one source of violence that they see regularly. And there's just something about the historical authenticity and the realization that this is, in fact, the gospel account that they've read and sort of glossed over mm-hmm. in their minds, mm-hmm. that's an important experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes. But we go through a box and a half of tissues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this year for Good Friday, what I was in the process of reading this book by Thomas Schmidt called A Scandalous Beauty. And I had ordered it on a recommendation from a trusted source.
That was very mysterious, by the way. I like that.
What's that?
my trusted source told me.
Oh, it was just, I'm not trying to be mysterious. It's just a podcast that I listened to.
No. Very mysterious.
Oh, go with that. Go with that.
All right. Very mysterious and trusted source. And it coincided really well with Lent. And there was this interesting chapter in the book titled The Man Who Would Be God. And basically the author goes through and outlines, he suggests that the gospel account of Mark is a direct parallel to the Roman triumph. That Mark intentionally writes his gospel account of Jesus's trial and the entire sequence of events that take place prior to and leading up through the crucifixion as he believes that Mark is intentionally highlighting the parallels with the Roman triumph. So he down to things like the praetorium, which is where the Roman emperor who is to be crowned, he would start his triumphal entry at the praetorium, which is where Jesus begins. And then they would go into the praetorium and they would dress the emperor in his royal robes and place a crown on his head, which would be taken from a statue of Jupiter who had a red face, mm-hmm. and Jesus's face was red, and the crown of thorns, and the robes, and then just walks it all the way through, and the mm-hmm. correlations were stunning. I never read it before. I did a little bit of research after reading it, and he has a couple of articles that are online, and then there's one other source that has kind of done similar parallels mm-hmm. and studies on it. But it was fascinating.
That's really interesting to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, because I teach Roman history and we talk about the tradition of the Roman triumph and the development in Roman history from the triumphal procession of a victorious general being honored by the Republic and the way that the accumulated glory of the triumphs led to a sense of competition among Roman generals and Roman leaders, which is what brings us to Julius Caesar and the advent of the emperors in Rome. And so then to think about that in the first century BC, first century AD, and the association of the triumph with Caesar Augustus and the establishment of the Pax Romana, and mm-hmm. think about Mark deliberately working with that imagery and the advent of Christ. That's amazing to think about.
Well, and he very intentionally, his suggestion is that it's Nero, that Nero is taking the throne about the time Mark is visiting Paul, right mm-hmm. before Jesus visits him in the body of Jim Caviezel, and
as one does.
Well done. One point to John.
And Mark is there in Rome when Nero is doing his triumph, and he's sitting there and he's watching this. And he's like, no. I've seen this before, and I know who the true king is. And so I don't know if I can find it real quick. Here we go. This is from the book. So he kind of is taking biblical passages and then correlating them with a historical fact. Now, when the centurion who stood facing him saw that he had breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." The culmination of the triumph of all of this was, and for Nero, was not merely a roar of approval from the crowd. It involved a particular statement from the people of Rome, a ceremonial shout at the moment that the sacrifice was complete. Then and only then Nero could reveal his own divinity. He would hear the cry, "Triumph, the God appears." And so when that centurion says, "Truly, this is the Son of God,"
when the sacrifice is
complete, he is echoing
right
the words that are very similar to what the people of Rome would have said when the emperor had declared himself a god, essentially. Right. It was a fascinating article. Thomas Schmidt, the book's called The Scandalous Beauty, but you can find the article online in even more detail than is in the book. And anyway, it was fantastic.
Or I can steal the book from you, right?
Or you can steal it from me.
Right. Okay.
Here it is. I'm handing it to you now.
Very good.
You can call me a mysterious source.
So I got this book from a mysterious source.
Very mysterious.
I'll tell you about it later.
Yep. So, oh, golly.
Speaking of reading good books, if you want to read mid-20th century German philosophers, as one does.
As one does.
Joseph Piper.
Yes.
I watch your Facebook.
You do?
I saw your
Facebook.
Yeah. I Twitter? Something.
Oh, I probably updated my Goodreads. Like
the
which
best.
Then,
oh, it was Goodreads. Yeah. The best thing you've ever read or something like that.
One of the best things I've ever read.
Yeah. A little hyperbole or no?
No.
No hyperbole.
No.
So what book is this?
It's called Faith, Hope, Love.
There was a joke there. There was such a joke that you teed up for me there. Oh, Good Night, Moon. It was something. I just couldn't fit it in. Oh, gosh. Sorry. Faith, Hope, Love.
Yeah. And it's not really a book. It's three essays in one volume. And so it's his philosophical exploration of the concept of faith, hope, and love as theological virtues, the way they're formulated in the Middle Ages and in Christian doctrine. And so he talks about faith and the necessary trust in a person that is required by the meaning of the word belief. We only use the word belief in relationship to a person. And what that says about the distinctiveness of the Christian faith, so that we have faith in Christ and our belief is very much about our relationship to a person. Fabulous, rich, complex. His formulation of hope as the middle way between humility and magnanimity, which is not a word we use very often, but the striving for greatness. Mm-hmm. And so that sense that we are called by bearing the image of God, we're called to greatness. And yet hope is not appropriate unless it's balanced by the humility of recognizing our own limitations. Mm. But humility is insufficient without that call to greatness, which was just marvelous. And then his exploration of love, which probably gained somewhat, in my good opinion, because of the way he quoted C.S. Lewis about every third or fourth page. No.
Were they contemporaries?
Chuckle about that? Yes.
I'm just wondering if Jim Caviezel would ever consider playing C.S. Lewis. Maybe a Shadowlands remake.
Right.
Oh, my word.
Anthony Hopkins didn't quite do it for you.
Oh, my word.
Joseph Piper calls C.S. Lewis the greatest lay theologian.
There we go. I like that.
Which I thought was really great.
Yeah.
Especially considering that Lewis is extremely aggressively Protestant and Piper's Catholic. So that's fun.
Are you suggesting that both are Christians?
Yes.
Both belong to the Catholic Church.
In the little c sense.
Little,
yes.
Little c, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Dun, cool. Dun, dun.
Yeah. And the chapter on love was phenomenal. I couldn't do justice to it.
And this is just like, it's like a short book, right? It's not a full,
well, it's like
300 page.
Well, it's like 250 pages,
oh, wow,
but
okay.
Each
it's
section.
Larger for him then.
Yeah. Each section is fairly limited. The love section is the longest, a little over 100 pages, and the other two are 65, 70 pages each, but also fairly good-sized type and decent margins.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not talking about a serious investment of time, just really thoughtful explorations of the philosophical implications of faith, hope, and love.
But Piper is, but he is a philosopher. This is not something that somebody should pick up and read and expect like flowery.
This is
insight.
Not super accessible.
Right. This is moderately
accessible for philosophy. Extremely accessible for philosophy. But not, I mean, we're not talking on the level
you're
of
not
the
gonna
purpose-driven
go from
life.
Max Lucado to reading Joseph Piper.
No.
Right.
Yes. Which is probably a good caveat to remember. But it's really good stuff.
Okay.
Thrilled with it. I think you guys should definitely read it.
No, it sounds fantastic. David's over here like, I'm thinking about Infinity War.
Kind of a little bit.
Have you read Lewis's The Four Loves?
I have. Yep.
Okay. Well, yep. Four Loves is quoted extensively.
Well, I like that.
In Joseph Piper.
Can we go back just for a moment? I don't know why I'm like the grammar Nazi tonight, but you said magnanimous. Wasn't that the word you said?
Magnanimity.
Magnanimity. So how did you define that?
Aspiring after greatness.
Aspiring after greatness. That is not the definition I remember.
Me neither.
Okay.
Generosity.
I would have gone with that.
But generosity in the sense of the grand gesture, not the small.
Right.
So if
a magnanimous king, for example.
Right.
Giving good gifts, giving heroic gifts.
Yes. Right. And yeah.
So not striving for greatness in the sense of
slaying dragons.
Yeah, or ego. Or...
Well, not in the sense of ego, but definitely in the sense of as a bearer of the image of God, I'm called to do whatever is required of me, which probably includes something that's just beyond my capabilities. Not, you know, being content with, I'm pretty good, but that my calling as a Christian is something that's going to be beyond my human limits in some sense.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I've been thinking about that a bit in the context of work and vocation and how we often end up with just such a mix of motives and desires and a sense of what it is we're actually doing. And that striving after greatness or success in some worldly sense is a pretty universal characteristic of human working lives. We want to have recognition and greatness in some sense in our vocation.
Mm-hmm.
And so Piper's formulation of the theological virtue of hope that God will accomplish great things comes in the midst of the balance between recognizing our own limitations and the limitations of our calling. I'm a small person in a small corner of the world called to do the task in front of me, not to fantasize about what I would do with greater powers, but
building a platform.
Right.
And raising lots of money and having many converts or whatever.
Great influence or whatever.
Right.
Right.
Not to say that for some people he doesn't call them to that.
Right, but I have to recognize...
Yeah, but there is definitely in America right now, there is a whole genre of books at any... If there are physical bookstores still left in the world, there is
maybe
a whole
somewhere.
Genre of self-help where the entire goal is to make yourself into a little demigod.
Yeah,
right.
I gotcha.
So
that sense of that it's not a matter of eschewing all accomplishment. It's a matter of recognizing the balance between and seeing that God does great things through servants, humble servants, and that great as it's defined in the kingdom of God is not often what's defined as great in the world.
Right.
And that aspiration and that desire to do the heroic and the great thing is best fulfilled in humble recognition of my own limitations, but then in the heroic sacrifice that day-to-day community and life in the church requires. And so, yeah. Does that resonate at all? Or am I just...
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking to David to take the torch there. He's thinking about it.
David's like, well, thanks a lot. Hand it off.
No, I just don't want to talk too much. We just got done.
Wait. Did you just say I don't want to talk too much? I think that's what he said. Right?
It is what he said.
I heard.
Yeah.
I have a tendency to talk a lot. In case you guys hadn't noticed.
Okay.
You have that tendency?
I do.
I thought I was monopolizing that over here.
Self-awareness is part of what I'm working on.
I completely interrupted. So.
We just got done with a men's retreat where we talked about the book of Nehemiah, and one of the guys at our church who I asked to lead one of the discussion times, and he's fairly new to our church. He said, wait, we're doing Nehemiah and we're not like trying to raise money for anything, like a building project or remodel or
time to stand in the gap.
And what I found so fascinating about the Book of Nehemiah is that Nehemiah is not, he is not a religious figure, and he is not a miraculous figure. Mm-hmm. And pretty much he may not be the only one, but he's the only one that really comes to mind that kind of fits this like bureaucratic role. Like even Joseph becomes essentially a king.
Right.
And Nehemiah never gets to do that. Nehemiah never fights in a battle. Mm-hmm. He never slays a giant. He never does. He's essentially an administrator.
A community organizer.
Yeah. And he...
community organizer.
Well, think about it. Like, what more frustrating job could there possibly be? Like, get everybody on board with a difficult long-term task.
Well...
go.
Yeah, exactly. And is faithful for the long term. And the thing that stood out to me in that book is how much of that book is just about work. Mm-hmm. And the goodness of work. Mm-hmm. Like the thing that is often highlighted is that they built the wall in 52 days, but he is the governor of that region, of that province, for I think it's 10 years.
Right.
Which just sucked, I'm sure. That was not like something easy to do. You had a bunch mm-hmm. of rebellious people and you're fighting with your neighbors constantly in and out. I mean, the whole experience, and yet he's just a faithful. He's faithful in what he has been called mm-hmm. to do. He sees it. Like we were talking about calling, he is very clear what his role is. His role is not to play politician with the neighbors, not to make friends. His role is to reinforce the city, provide, mm-hmm. build that safety back up. He even has forces from the king. Like my son Ethan went to the retreat with us, and my son, I didn't totally had never seen this before, but he has a Babylonian Medes and Persians issued guard, royal guard with him. And when his enemies attack him, he doesn't use the guard to go and smash his enemies, which would be the most natural thing in the world for him right. to have done. And he just kind of keeps on trudging along, doing his thing, And I think that is often what faithfulness and work and calling looks mm-hmm. like, rather than, tweeting to your 800,000 followers.
Right.
Some stupidly witty 128 characters.
About how awesome you are and how you get it.
Or about you with a picture of an orphan in
right.
Wakanda.
The Wakandan orphans are very well taken care of. I think that's part of the point.
I think the he goes off to, he has to go back to Babylon to go, talk to the king, whatever, and he comes back after a while and things are completely falling apart. Because they're not taking care of the temple. They're, going off and ignoring God again. And he's like, okay, this is not happening. And and he's really serious. Like, I almost think that, I do think that Nehemiah had, like you say, like he wasn't just focused on it being a single job or like being the representative of the king. His focus was being honoring to Yahweh and
right. So seeing beyond the immediate task into
what is more important,
this, the implications of that task. Right.
Well, and to the point of self-sacrifice, like in, I think it's chapter 4, chapter 5 of Nehemiah, it goes into deep detail about how there is it sounds like a majority of Israelites who are oppressed. Mm-hmm. Like the rich people have taken their land and are beginning to take their children in payment for the food that they're eating because there's a drought in the land. Mm-hmm. And when Nehemiah learns of it, he says, look, like I'm not taking my governor's allowance. I'm not building houses because I came back to rescue this people, and now you are turning around and trying to sell them to me again. And I think that is the battle that that's like the realism that was missing from Black Panther, in a sense.
Right.
That this is a real battle, and
right.
and there is real sacrifice, and not that mm-hmm. they wouldn't, and again, with all the caveats, not that they aren't going to get there, but like
right.
Nehemiah is actually having to make sacrifices of his own future. He's leveraging his own ability to make money. mm-hmm. There's some debate about whether, the wine taster for the king was an important job or like a disposable job.
Right.
I would land on the side that it was a really important job, that it was a very trusted advisor to the king. You can't just give anybody the role of being the person who literally tastes your food before you eat it in an ancient culture.
Right.
And so he would have had a lot more personal opportunity if he had stayed with the king, or if he had used his role as governor of that province of Israel differently.
Well, and I mean, I've never been in a real position of leadership, but as in the last few years of my life, I've had a few opportunities to just be on the edges of leadership or lead in a small way. And it's made me really, much more sensitive to the struggles and the burdens of the kind of day-to-day leadership that has to be done in so many aspects of our life. And I think that Nehemiah is a really good illustration of this. And then I wasn't at your men's retreat, or studying the book of Nehemiah recently, but it seems to resonate with a lot of the things that, I've been just thinking about in this context, because, you know, our concept of leadership is so far from what the reality of leadership is, which is probably why leadership is so often done so badly. But that great personal risk for very uncertain future returns and great personal sacrifice for great... personal rejection rather than great personal glory. You know, that our superhero movies, our epic poetry, our novels always offer that sense of satisfaction, accomplishment, and recognition at the end of the quest, at the end of, you know, leading the quest. Nobody doubts that Gandalf is valued and appreciated by his followers. And yet in the day-to-day leadership roles, I see the people who are trying to lead me and my colleagues. I see the people who are trying to lead the congregation that I attend and see how little understood or appreciated they are mm-hmm. and how frequently judged, misunderstood, or just flat out ignored, and think about that tension of hope. How do you have hope in accomplishing anything when you have pretty much 100% guarantee of being misunderstood, misinterpreted, and rejected? And all you're trying to do is make sure that your tiny little congregation keeps on following God. Mm-hmm. You're not rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. You're mm-hmm. just keeping one little small congregation in one little small city in probably the least significant state in the U.S. Sorry, Idaho.
Not
I love you.
According to Forbes magazine.
We're not
the
Wyoming.
Least significant? We're the second least significant?
We're the most popular place in the country to move to right now.
Oh, yes.
To Forbes, so.
Well, there's that whole thing where our population density is so low, we just have a lot of room for expansion.
Well, there's a lot of mountains.
Right. And that big wilderness area.
I definitely agree with what you're saying. I think that the epitome of leadership...
Epitome, seriously.
Yeah, John. Srzly. Srzly.
Oh my goodness. Please never do that voice again.
The epitome of leadership is really being a servant. Is in everything. And I think that the mark of a good leader, one of the marks of a good leader, is humility.
And but we think about servant leadership in the sense of, oh, he's serving us by leading us. Don't we appreciate him for his service? But that's not what it is to be a servant. It's to be invisible.
Yeah.
Forgotten.
And, yeah. And it, so I really think so much of it comes back to humility, mm-hmm. and not thinking that highly of yourself and not seeking to gain glory for yourself.
Right.
That you've got a goal, and your goal doesn't have anything to do with you. Your goal is the health of the organization that you're leading.
Right.
But the flip side of the humility argument is also not to think too lowly of yourself.
Sure. Right. And, sure.
And so to balance that, it with that magnanimity.
There's a tension.
Where you're at.
Of like,
right.
Hope.
Like, I have authority in this situation. I have the ability to leverage my positional power in such a way that I can affect change.
Not just an ability, a responsibility.
A responsibility.
Yes.
Sure.
I'm called to
stand up and do the right thing.
Rebuild that wall.
Yeah, right.
But your motives for doing that are 100% for the health of the organization. And motives are something that tends to come out pretty quickly.
And we can get on a whole different, but here you're seeing this with all the different controversies or all the different scandals that are happening right now, whether church leaders or movie stars or directors or politicians. Motives.
Sitcom.
Yeah. Sitcom stars. The motives.
Wait, did I miss something?
Are a super.
Bill Cosby got.
Oh, yeah. Today. Convicted and sentenced or convicted. Yeah.
Yeah. And motives are an incredibly tricky thing. And
say incredibly tricky thing like it's hard to know what the right thing to do is. But incredibly tricky thing doesn't mean it's hard to know.
It is hard to know.
It's hard to know what I want.
It is hard.
But it's not hard to know what's right.
Ooh. Fight. I don't think John agrees.
I don't.
You don't think it's hard?
I don't agree. I think there has been a really hard swing right now where people are sitting back and they're saying, how could this have happened? And it's really easy to sit back and look at somebody else when you're not in that situation and those circumstances and the pressures that are on those. I'm not defending Bill Cosby. I'm not defending
Harvey Weinstein.
And some of this, we don't know what the circumstances
right.
that I'm not trying to defend anyone, but I am going to say there are lots of people with really good intentions who end up in really, like, you see this all the time with pastors who run off with the church secretary, and you have lots of people who have the best intentions in the world and they end up in a mess. And we see it with King David, and we see it with who is a man after God's own heart. And so how do you square? It's really easy for us to sit back and pass judgment on a Bill Hybels or a King David and say that's horrible. And it is. It is. It's there's not an excuse for it. But to try to say, like, it's wrong and we shouldn't do it versus it's wrong and and that is what it means to be fallen. Like,
right. Well, okay. So I guess I don't think we'd actually disagree. Sorry, David. We're not going to actually Donnie
Man.
Book. But I mean, I think it's never hard to know what the right thing to do is. I think it's hard to do the right thing, and it's hard not to try to justify the wrong thing.
I think,
like, our fallenness makes it so easy to not look straight at the decision, but kind of keep it in the peripheral vision where it's easy to kind of pretend we don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, and I say this as someone who has given into temptations before.
Yeah, right.
You know you're giving into temptation when you give into temptation. And you know you're excusing something you shouldn't excuse. And you know you're putting yourself in a bad situation when you're doing it. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not looking at it at the moment, because looking at it would require facing what God calls us to.
Mm-hmm.
So you are closing your eyes, but that's an act of your will. You are willfully doing that. So mm-hmm. I don't think that
sinful desires will, James and all that stuff. Yeah.
I don't think there's a single point in Bill Cosby's career, where he was genuinely confused about whether or not it was okay to drug a woman and then take sexual advantage of her.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point in his life where he was actually genuinely confused about the moral boundaries there. It was willful collusion with himself to pretend he's not noticing.
Agree. I think we're having two different conversations. So yes, I agree with everything that you just said. I also think the danger in what you're saying and how this conversation is taking place on a national stage right now is that we are having this conversation like, how does this happen? Like, we don't know.
Well,
how does it happen?
I'm with you. Yeah, I think that reaction is absurd.
Yeah.
How does it happen? We're sinners. Have you met you?
Right.
You'll do this.
And this is the key. Like, this is the word that we've lost from the national conversation that's missing is the word sin.
Right.
And it messes with you, and it does complicate situations where suddenly the way you're saying is we don't look directly at situations. We don't look because we have sin clouding our vision.
When
there is no light in our body, when the eye is bad, how great is the darkness?
Right.
And at a national level right now, our darkness is at an incredibly high level.
Well, and I think I've heard aspects of the conversation that seem to reflect this. So the difference between, and this is just an illustration, but I had a conversation with a female colleague talking about her husband being shocked by one of these breaking scandals. Can you believe that so-and-so would do this? And her daughter both turning to him like, yeah, duh. Just, you know, hear the guy talk. It's clear that he would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of this disconnect in his read of like how shocking that some guy would do that. And then both his wife and his daughter going, it's not at all shocking that that guy would do that,
mm-hmm.
that you can read it all over the way he talks about these things. It seemed really obvious. I would seek to protect myself from that guy. So that I think that just is an illustration of the larger pattern that there are sin patterns that we might be sensitive to or not sensitive to. And it can be really easy to recognize how that could happen. And so that sort of shocked, like, I can't believe that so-and-so would do this. Well, no, obviously so-and-so would do this. That's the classic pitfall of leadership, is to be tempted to that sin. So how would I be shocked that somebody who had achieved great popularity and prestige might be tempted in?
But we are. When we speak, so two things. One, when we set people up on a pedestal,
yes,
we've done it ourselves. We've done it to ourselves. And then two, when we are disappointed with people that we've set up on the pedestal, we've done it to ourselves.
Yes.
And this is the problem with the conversation. So especially when it comes to Christian leaders, who should know better. We, as people who aren't in those positions of popularity, should also know better. We have an entire book full of fallen leaders, and we keep on acting like we're shocked when the latest revelation comes out that so-and-so did such and such with the church secretary or whatever it was.
Right.
And we're like, what? And I just think then there is a naiveness that we have, mm-hmm. when we have this expectation on our leaders that is, I'm not saying we shouldn't have high expectations. I'm not saying that what anything that they did is right, but for us to stand back and go, I can't believe it, is the epitome, the epitome of naivete.
But it's somebody that you thought you could trust.
Don't trust.
Yeah. And it's somebody you thought you could trust because at some point you believed that human righteousness was a possibility, that David, you could be good apart from Christ's righteousness, or that I could be good apart from Christ's righteousness. And clearly, if, you know, Bill Hybels or whoever and King David trusted in himself, or, you know, worshipped himself or his own comfort or his own desire above God. And so, like, when we say, you know, I there but for the grace of God go I, or we have some recognition that that is possible for anyone, then we maybe begin to understand what the gospel is really about. But I, in some sense, I don't think it's possible to be shocked by, you know, local pastor had an adulterous affair. I can't be shocked.
So the title of this podcast should be "Don't Trust Anyone."
I'm sure that's a good title for it. It will inspire all of our listeners to feel hopeful and joyful about and life, loving. The universe, and everything.
And loving and faithful.
Yes. Yeah. But don't trust anyone because, of course,
nobody's worthy of being trusted.
None of us.
Maybe the better way of saying that is that
trust only
Christ. We're often trying to look for kings, and we're making kings out of people, and instead of...
We want Nero's triumph and not Christ's.
Christ's triumph, exactly.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay, we found the title.
We did.
Nero's triumph instead of Christ.
And Nero's a great illustration of that because he failed so spectacularly.
He was kind of a bad dude.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of a little bit.
He's almost a byword. Godwin's law, really, but it's pretty much there.
I felt like your Bill Cosby reference was a little bit of a Godwin's law, but okay.
What's that?
Never mind.
Okay.
how long will it take us to get
How long
to
will
Bill
it
Cosby?
Take us to get, yeah, basically you use Bill Cosby as a Nazi.
Yeah.
It was the Nazi reference there.
Bill Cosby's the new Hitler?
The new Hitler when it comes, yeah, okay. He's kind of the Hitler of Me Too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all of his toil. This is God's gift to man. In other words, that's the best role for us in our work. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it nor taken away from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. And that's that idea of respect. That which is already has been, that which was to be, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. It's good old Ecclesiastes.
I love which Solomon.
Is, yeah. It's depressing, and yet it's realistic.
It is not. It's hopeful that yeah. my
we're,
best work will pass away.
Important.
Yeah, we're not that important.
Right. And that then
in
relieves me.
Disney says, okay, yeah. we need to wrap
yeah.
it.
Yeah, probably. We've been talking
home.
Forever. Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Sleep is important.
Yeah. This has been lots of fun. Anyway, thanks for being here. John, do you have a song of the week to leave us with?
No, this is kind of a not upbeat song, but I found it messing around on
we just ended with Ecclesiastes.
Yeah,
I think we're okay.
Good. This is a guy named Josh White. This is an older song. I just found it and I loved it. So we can end with this.
Alrighty. I'm David.
Amanda.
John.
Is that